Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Unauthorized Disclosure Podcast. I'm Kevin Gastola, joined by my co-host, Rania Kalik. Hello, Rania.
Hey, Kevin.
And we're very pleased to welcome a first-time guest, but we're really happy to be meeting her, Hadas Thier, who is an activist and socialist in New York, the author of A People's Guide to Capitalism, An Introduction to Marxist Economics, and a regular contributor to Jacobin Magazine. She can be found on Twitter at Hadas Thier. So welcome. It's good to talk to you.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to join you.
All right. So you wrote this article. I'll put it up on the screen. Although it's called "The A Left Answer to Inflation," and it dives into the Chicago School of Economics. But of course, all of that is very topical at the moment with the midterms. We're focused on what does inflation in the economy have as far as, what kind of outcomes we might be seeing, but it's definitely on everyone's mind because these are bread and butter issues. But to get to the crux of what you lay out, you do propose some ideas for answering, but I guess let's start with, the problem of inflation and what I thought this was a really good part of your article to start out with, where you say that, behind some of the more technical economic arguments lies a political class war principle. Why must business owners pass off rising costs to consumers through price hikes? After all, if wages went up and prices were to stay the same, that simply means a greater share of profits would go to workers rather than capitalists. Inflation, therefore, is a side of class conflict, a battle of which class is gaining at the other's expense. So I guess before we get to the answer, why don't I have you discuss this class conflict that inflation is really all about?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the way that inflation gets talked about and the way that, the economy and big, uppercase E, the boogeyman of the economy gets talked about is it's just, some technical objective thing out there. That's just the way it is. If unemployment is, God forbid, too low, then we have this problem with the economy. The only solution to it is these technical fixes where the Federal Reserve raises the interest rates. Unfortunately, that has some painful consequences, but what can you do? That's the economy, and stripped from all of this is really the political content of everything. We live in a capitalist society. It's a political economic system. There's no way to separate out inflation from political questions of who pays the price and who gains. And everything about the way that inflation is being talked about in mainstream discussion assumes that the rate of profit should always remain absurdly and grotesquely high. I mean, the national share of income, the labor share of national income going to, how much money of, of what is generated, how much of it goes to labor in terms of wages, has been, on the decline, has fallen off of a cliff, basically, since the 1980s. And that's just, considered, par for the course and how things should be. So with the question of inflation, the assumption is that if the cost of producing things goes up for whatever reason, whether it's, supply chain chokeholds, which, clearly offset the current situation, whether it's the war in Russia, whether it's, a number of different things we could talk about, whatever the cause of it, then the only solution is that bosses should still be able to make the same amount of money. So if it's costing them more to produce something, then they should charge us more for it. And the only way to tame inflation is to reduce demand by basically increasing unemployment and making it harder for us to buy the things that we need.
And yeah, just to be clear here, when we're talking about inflation, and as you note in this piece, I mean, the issue of inflation, of course, we're constantly told is like, well, they're blaming on different things. Republicans are like, it's the Democrats. Democrats are responsible. And then both are saying, oh, it's like because of the war in Ukraine. When actually, like, the a lot of this inflation that we're seeing right now is literally just companies jacking up their prices. Mm-hmm. And so in if we weren't going by, we can talk more about like the sort of neoliberal, like Friedmanite economics behind this. But if we weren't like going by that sort of rubric, it's because right now the people in power act like there's only one way to deal with inflation, and that's to raise unemployment. But actually, there's something called price controls. Can you talk about what would be the more effective way to deal with this that wouldn't cause so much suffering among average people?
Yeah, absolutely. I think price controls is so important. And I think, unfortunately, it's kind of, you know, disappeared out of mainstream discussion. It used to be much more commonplace to talk about it. And obviously, and I go through some of this history in the article, but in the 1940s through FDR's administration and so on, it was widely used and very effectively used. And there are, you know, elements of price controls that we see here and there that are extremely effective, you know, in very few places. I benefit from living in New York City where there are some regulations on rent, not enough, it's been watered down. But these kinds of things are incredibly effective and important. And they get at this whole question of inflation being a site of class conflict, because who does price controls hurt? Obviously, it hurts corporate profits when they could be taking advantage of the moment that we're in, which they are through price gouging, as you mentioned. You know, the way that the market is allowed to, you know, reign free is basically to allow for, you know, things like price gouging is just part, you know, that's just how things go with the way that the market is. If there's high demand for goods and services, then corporations know they can get away with jacking up prices. And that's just how things go. And the only way to curb that kind of thing is through government intervention, is through things like price controls. And it really gets to the heart of, you know, a more both, you know, creates more equality, but a more democratic approach to the economy and to economic planning, and that the government should have some kind of a role, an interventionist role in actually protecting people from, you know, certainly price gouging, but in general, you know, the wild fluctuations of the market.
And so let me bring in another part of your article that I thought was really good, because you tell a history of inflation and the way that it has really impacted people and been a part of economic crises. And so this was another section that I pulled out, and it relates to what we've been seeing, because people, especially in the progressive side, have been following with great interest the unprecedented organizing that seems to be taking up the resurgence of union organizing. And you wrote, whether or not wages contribute to inflation, a slack labor market remains a priority for American capitalists because of the precedent that increased workers' bargaining power could portend. A tight labor market opens the way to greater gains and organizing efforts for workers, like this year's wave of Starbucks union drives. And I'll just note that you get into this Bank of America memo right after that part of your article. But I suppose, why don't we spend a moment with you fleshing out how the way they deal with inflation is also very useful to the capitalist class in making it so that labor doesn't have control over workplaces, isn't able to make the decisions and steer the direction. It makes it possible for the CEOs and the boardrooms to maintain their power.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a really important question, because, you know, first of all, at best, they're, you know, the mainstream approach to inflation is at best a very blunt instrument, right? You just raise interest rates, that quote unquote cools the economy, which means there's less investment in the production of goods and services. And that means that there's less employment. And there, you know, then you kind of over time, and it takes quite some time of pain and suffering, it reduces demand. And like I said, in a best case scenario, that's a very blunt instrument. So reducing demand for things like food, which is, you know, one of the key places where inflation has been hitting. What does that mean to reduce demand for food? It means that less people are able to afford food, to afford healthy food, and so on. So that's you know, the best case scenario is that it's just a blunt and awful instrument. But the other aspect of it is, like you said, it, you know, it works very well with, you know, what the capitalist class, what corporations and financial, you know, capitalists and so on are interested in, which is an environment that is conducive to businesses making profit. That is the whole heart of how our system works, and that's the name of the game. So having a quote unquote tight labor market is, you know, really worrisome for the capitalist class, whether or not it has anything to do with driving up inflation. And I think most serious economists acknowledge that wages are not really what's driving inflation in this case. So, you know, when you have a quote unquote tight labor market, and I'm just putting that in quotes because it's one of these like euphemisms of mainstream economics, as you talk about things in that way, when really what you mean is that unemployment is low. That should be a good thing. Anyone who just says low unemployment, that seems obviously good, but you put, you couch it in these, you know, in these terms, to make it sound like it's just a problem for the economy. There's a tight labor market. When there's low unemployment, it means that that generally increases workers' bargaining power. Workers tend to be more confident to make demands on the job if they know that if they happen to lose that job because of organizing efforts or what have you, that they're not going to be that hard-pressed to find another job. And the main thing that really inhibits our ability to effectively organize and push for higher demands at workplaces is the fear of losing our jobs. And so, you know, Karl Marx actually talked about this, you know, quite well a very long time ago, which is, you know, that he talked about the reserve army of labor under capitalism, which is to say that capitalism needs unemployment. You know, that is their that is the way to help mitigate workers' confidence and workers' demands. That's how they keep workers' wages generally as low as they've been able to. You know, and that gets to the heart of this response to inflation. And in some ways, it's just an ineffective response. In other ways, it's a lot more nefarious, which is that it's just a useful, you know, tool and an excuse to go after low unemployment rates.
Right. So reserve army of labor that capitalism requires. But, you know, when we talk about these different responses to the inflation crisis, well, there's kind of two things I want to ask you here. One, does the business-friendly version even actually work? Like, this is just kind of all theoretical. Yeah. Like, does it, like, even if, let's say, you know, it's a blunt force instrument, causes, like, drives up unemployment, does it even work? Just, you know, with all that suffering, does it actually work? One, and then, actually, yeah, let's start there because I don't want to throw on too many questions on top of each other.
Yeah, no, I think it's a great question. And I think it's certainly very debatable. And, you know, in the 1970s, you could make the case that it worked for some people, not for most people. It created major devastation that has been long lasting, has been decades, you know, has had decades long effect. But it worked for the capitalist class in part because it went as far as it did. You know, which is not really what Jeremy Powell or the Federal Reserve are talking about right now, at least not yet. That, you know, Paul Volcker, who is the head of the Fed at the time, was just willing to go where no man had been willing to go, you know, because he wasn't afraid of the political backlash or whatever, and just drove interest rates to such a high extent. It was called the Volcker shock, that it did, you know, drive the country relatively quickly into a pretty bad recession. And so in that sense, you know, it worked. But it, you know, there are all sorts of very ineffective aspects of raising interest rates. You know, it depends on what kind of causes we are even dealing with in terms of inflation. In this case, we have mostly a problem of supply chokeholds. It's not really such an issue of demand, although that's played into it. And so when you raise interest rates and you drive, and that lowers the amount of investment, because, you know, corporations need lots of cheap money in order to invest. Mm-hmm. When you raise interest rates and lower the amount of investment, that actually makes things worse in a lot of cases in terms of those supply chokeholds. It's not, you know, so when you think about things like baby formula, or you think about things like, you know, semiconductors, which are needed for cars. And that, those were some of, you know, just to name a couple of examples of things that there were major problems in terms of the supply. You know, raising interest rates certainly doesn't help with any of that. And in some cases makes it worse.
Hello, everyone. I'm Kevin Gustola. I'd like to take a brief moment to ask you to become a subscriber of the Unauthorized Disclosure podcast. Just go to thedissenter.org. At the top, you'll see a black button that says subscribe. Click on it and you'll get options. And for $4 a month or $3, if you become an annual subscriber, you can get access to all of our premium episodes as well as any exclusive content that we post. Now, back to the interview.
And then I guess then the other thing that I would want to ask you about in this case is, it seems like, so you have this theoretical framework that could maybe work, maybe not, but obviously causes like a mass amount of suffering to people by raising unemployment. But let's say it doesn't work. I don't know if like you have a response to this, but I've seen this kind of speculation by economists that we're sort of stuck in this never-ending inflation loop. And there's no way to bring it down because of all the factors. Maybe that would be a good place to go here is, you know, we mentioned a couple of reasons there's inflation, but it's not just that corporations are jacking up prices, right? It's like a series of things. So can you walk us through what is currently causing this inflation crisis? And is there a precedent? Because it's so many different things. And it's like, yes, there's a war, but there was years of stagnation or stagflation. I'm not really quite sure what that word means. Maybe you can explain that. But yeah, what is driving this inflation crisis? And if it's unprecedented, do we really know how to get out of it beyond, you know, if we're going to pretend price controls don't exist?
Right. I mean, I don't think it's completely unprecedented. I think that the inflationary crisis in the 70s was deeper and worse. Some of what is unprecedented is, you know, the state of the economy in general, like during a pandemic, we just haven't lived through that. And so we've seen some very wild ups and downs, that, you know, you can't just take out the old history books, you know, the old economic history books and map the past onto the present, because it's a very strange moment that we're living in for sure. But I think that, you know, a big part of what initially caused the inflation that we're seeing, and then there have been a few things that have made it hard to get out of and made it stickier, but the thing that initially caused it is, you know, this unprecedented shock to the economy in terms of the pandemic, where, you know, having the entire economy kind of shut down and then restart is a very difficult thing for capitalism to do. You know, capitalism is not very agile anyway, but then in the context of that kind of wild start and stop kind of thing that we saw during the pandemic. You had, you know, when the economies reopened around the globe, you know, the supply chains just weren't able to keep up with them because so many things had been shut down. And, you know, a lot of this, I would just say, you know, just in terms of some of the big picture and to go back to Marx a little bit, is that because everything in our society is driven by a profit motive, because we're so subjected to the whims of the market, it just means that those kind of wild ups and downs take a huge toll. Like, why is it that companies had to, you know, shut down production because demand was going down? That's because it wasn't profitable for them to stay open, right? Everything that is done for the sake of profitability. So I think that that's kind of a key thing to draw out there. But I think ultimately, like, the big part of the story was mostly the supply chains. They couldn't ramp back up quickly. Another aspect of that I think is worth footnoting there is that a big reason why they can't ramp up quickly is that, you know, this neoliberal trend for just-in-time production, where companies keep as little on reserve and inventory as possible so that they save costs in storage. But that just means that they, you know, can't quickly provide supply when things change like that. So I think that that's the kind of main driver, but then some things have made it stick around for longer. And I would just add that there's a lot of, you know, a lot of the places where we're seeing the highest inflation are places where there's been an ongoing crisis for a long time. So, like, housing prices, mm-hmm. you know, rents skyrocketing, the food market is, you know, just awful. Mm-hmm. The fact that you have a food market as opposed to just food for people, you know, should give you a clue. But these are, you know, or the cost of education. I mean, these are long-standing problems that have been exacerbated, but that, you know, until they bothered the capitalist class and profitability, they weren't talked about. You know, we should have been talking about rent inflation, education, food, all of these things for a long time. Absolutely. And I think that's one of the most hopeful things, along with the, you know, organizing efforts that are going on that you mentioned earlier. That's one of the most hopeful things that we've seen in the last couple of years, is it's an example of actually the government can be responsible. It's just, you know, that's something that's kind of been erased from discussion since the 1980s and Reaganomics and so on. The boogeyman of big government, you know, actually the government could send us checks, you know, and increase unemployment benefits. You know, during the pandemic, during a major shock to the economy, actually inequality dropped. It's now back on the incline. But it just goes to show that huge, you know, this is what the government actually could be capable of doing. And I think it's something that the left really needs to internalize, and help to shape the kind of demands that we make about what's possible. You know, that the unemployment system that we have in this country is awful. It's just like this patchwork system where some states you get a measly crumbs and some states you get a few more. But we had the federal government actually step in and provide enough unemployment benefits that people didn't fall into poverty, mm-hmm. and actually managed to increase their savings. That's a good thing. You know, that's the kind of thing that the talking heads are really upset about right now, that there was too much savings accumulated. You know, that's a problem that's caused inflation. And they're not talking about the fact that, yeah, we decreased child poverty. You know, that's something to be proud of, and to push for more.
In fact, like you mentioned in your piece, you had Larry Summers like warning. He was like raising alarm bells. You can't give people money.
Yeah. Exactly.
That's all right. So speaking of Larry Summers, and then correct me if I'm wrong, but this is someone who comes from the Chicago School of Economics. He's a Friedmanite. Would you categorize him as a Friedmanite, right?
Yeah.
Or is he a different school of economic thought?
He's a, I mean,
he's a neoliberal.
I feel like Larry Summers is a school in and of himself in a way, no?
I mean, there's a whole wide range of just right wing economics, and they all kind of, there's a lot of overlap, but you know, people like Larry Summers or people like Volcker, for that matter, who we talked about earlier, you know, they're willing to, their principles aren't that committed. You know, they're willing to go with like monetarist ideas of the Friedmanites when it suits them, and then they drop them when it doesn't suit them. But I would classify broadly a number of these different schools as just, you know, conservative economic thought.
Okay. So, and he's pretty well known because I think he had a role in Bill Clinton's administration.
He was Treasury Secretary.
Yeah. Okay. He was just, okay. And he was on Anderson Cooper. So this is someone, I mean, watching this clip is amazing because Anderson Cooper is basically treating Larry Summers like he's an oracle. Like he can predict the future of the US economy. So that's a bizarre in and of itself. But I'm going to play this. We'll stop about like a minute or so into it so you can respond, and then we'll finish it and then we'll wrap up the show. But I just thought this would be a good way to end because this is where the ruling class's discussion of the issue is at currently.
You know, I think you should never in economics make a statement with complete certainty, but I think the likely thing is that we will have a recession. We don't have any experience with soft landings from high inflation without recessions. And I don't think there's anything in this particular pattern of events right now to suggest that that's something that's terribly likely. So I think the economy is likely sometime in the next year and a half to go into recession, unfortunately.
Do you have a sense of how long that may be?
I think it's not going to be a recession like the financial crisis was. It's not going to be a recession where millions and millions of people are going to be laid off in a month like took place during the pandemic. I think the kind of recession we had when the dot-com bubble burst in the year 2000 is probably a way to think about it. I'd expect the unemployment rate to get near 6, and I would expect it to stay elevated for perhaps a couple of years.
All right. So I'll stop there and just let you respond to what we've heard on his the Oracle's predictions.
Yeah, it's incredible to see how somebody like Larry Summers gets treated. And that's really the thing I was saying earlier about the economy. It's like the economy, which is its own, you know, entity. And then the economists are these oracles, and they can tell you when and how we will have recessions, and talk about it in this dry way, like, oh yeah, well, we'll have elevated unemployment for a couple of years, and that's just how it goes, you know? And
6%, like it's nothing.
Like it's no big deal. Like, okay, well, you know, hundreds of thousands of people thrown out of their jobs, and that's what we'll take to come down off of this inflation. You know, it's just, it's totally outrageous and despicable in my opinion, that this is you know, people's profession and way of life is to talk about these things and to advocate. I mean, Larry Summers in this case is talking about these things as though he's predicting it, but Larry Summers has been very actively advocating for elevated rates of unemployment, and he says the only way that we can reduce inflation is if we get, you know, that 5-7% unemployment for a couple of years, or 10% unemployment for a short amount of time. These are the policies that he's advocating for. And he's just happy that he's being listened to, because at a couple of years back when the stimulus bills were going through, when people were getting checks, these were incredibly popular policies that happened. And even, you know, among Republicans, Trump actually was the first, before Biden got into office, Trump actually helped to push through some of these stimulus bills. This is a sea change in the way that people think about government and the responsibility of government, like we were saying earlier. And Larry Summers was like a crank at the margins at the time, saying, no, you know, we can't do this. And he's just right now, like, so happy that his predictions of doom, you know, have not been proven to be true, but have in his mind have, and people are listening to him, and so on, and so forth. But the reality is that it, first of all, it is not the increased stimulus spending that was largely responsible for the rates of inflation. That's one thing to say. So he's not correct about that. And then the other thing to say, and this takes us back to earlier in the conversation, is that the solution to that absolutely does not have to be higher unemployment rates, that there are better solutions, that we should be talking about price controls. We should also be talking about taxing the rich and increasing corporate taxes. You know, there are actually a lot more pro, you know, working people, pro regular people policies that can get inflation under control and that can protect working people's pockets. And Larry Summers, isn't it?
So we obviously hear the sort of Larry Summers prescription, not just from him, you hear it from the chairman of the Fed. And basically anyone in a position and like the establishment, this is the kind of rhetoric you're hearing. There's no creativity on this at all. You just, even like people I talk to who are like annoying libs, you know, that's like who care about the economy. That's what they think is the only thing you could do to bring down inflation. I'm wondering, is there, I actually don't know, is there any move from anybody like on the margins? I'm even people like perhaps in the Congressional Progressive Caucus, or I haven't heard much from Bernie Sanders, but it might also be just because it hasn't come across my feed. Has Bernie Sanders or anybody in the squad or anyone on TV been talking about other avenues of dealing with this besides the sort of conventional prescription we're getting from Larry Summers?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great question. And, you know, Bernie Sanders has been talking about some of these issues, and he's also called for, I believe it was a 95% tax on corporations for anything above how they profited, you know, during the course of the pandemic. But really importantly, Jamal Bowman put out a bill in over the summer, I believe in August. I actually wrote an article about it for Jacobin, which people could look up. But it's a bill for price controls. Mm-hmm. And it's actually very well thought out. I think it's an excellent bill. And basically it puts forward all of these kinds of positions, you know, that the way that inflation is currently being fought is on the back of working people, that we need to actually protect working people's pockets and instead make corporations pay for this crisis. There's a lot built into the bill in terms of analysis and investigation, because price controls, unlike raising interest rates, are not something that you simply like flick on and off. It requires, you know, a lot of analysis and thought and to do it right. And so there's a lot built into the bill to do that. And I think, you know, one of the things that's important about it, you know, I don't think it'll pass anytime soon, given the current political context and the state of Congress and so on. But it changes the conversation. You know, the left needs to get better at being able to talk about economic issues. You know, the right and the Republicans and so on have always been able to, or at least in the last few decades, been able to take advantage of inflationary crises towards their benefit politically. And the left can't, you know, that's absurd. You know, the left needs to be able to put forward, you know, our analysis and our answer. And this brings the whole conversation of price controls back into the discussion. It would set up structures. It would put us, you know, create the infrastructure for actually more democratic planning of the economy now and in the long term. And I think that's something that's really important for us to get behind.
Mm. Yeah, I would agree that. And also, you know, you bring up a lot of history that I think isn't necessarily a part of daily conversation, unfortunately. Like when you discuss the economy, it's like not to dig into the issue, but I think because people have lived it and it's been so vivid, there are things that people can talk about over the last 20 to 25 years when it comes to, let's say, foreign policy and terrorism. It's pretty easy for people to give that post 9/11 history as they've experienced. But I don't feel like, even though it impacted millions of people, we're able to give that history. And we have to be able to counter the history that people in the ruling class are going to give. So I'll show you now. The Oracle gave a kind of history to Anderson Cooper and viewers about, you know, why he's saying the things that he has to say, which I think conflicts tremendously with the portrait that you've presented in your article for In These Times. But let's hear from him, and then you can give us your response.
Mm-hmm. What concerns you most right now in terms of the economy?
It's probably this phenomenon of trying to deal with overheating that we have at the same time that you're also trying to manage the economy so that you maximize what output we're producing and you maximize the number of people who have jobs. And it's probably the difficulty of finding that balance is what worries me most for the U.S. economy. I also worry that I think we're in a period of increased financial vulnerability relative to where we were some time ago, and that as interest rates rise, Warren Buffett had a picturesque example. He said, when the tide goes out, you start to see who's wearing a bathing suit and who isn't. And something a little like that is happening in the financial sector as we have the strains associated with higher interest rates. But there's no real alternative if we're going to avoid the kind of catastrophes we had in the 1970s that caused people to lose faith completely in government and ultimately led to the really very brutal recession of 1981 and 1982, where the unemployment rate crossed 10%.
Mm. Secretary Summers, I really appreciate your time tonight. Thank you.
Really appreciate it.
I like that at the end. Mm. Mm.
I'm so fascinated by, I'm grunting in fascination of your brilliance. Jesus Christ.
Yeah, I mean, it's just the exact, you know, just turning everything on its head. I mean, what's interesting, and there have been some sociologists that have done interesting work on this, and I quote them in my article, is that actually when inflation first started taking off in the 1970s, because the labor market was in a much stronger place then than it is now, and wages were higher, inflation was actually impacting the upper crust a lot more than it was impacting regular people. And that, you know, the question of inflation is always, are our wages keeping up with inflation? Mm-hmm. You know, over the last few decades, even though inflation has been very low, our wages have been even lower. So we haven't kept up with inflation, and therefore real wages have actually gone down. So in the 1970s, you had a very different thing where, yes, inflation was going up, but so were wages. So that kind of offset mitigated some of that crisis. It doesn't mean that there wasn't a problem of inflation that did need to be tackled. But the way that it was tackled is exactly what caused those extremely high unemployment rates that Larry Summers was talking about. It wasn't inflation that caused them. It was the response to inflation, the very same response that Larry Summers himself is advocating for right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, it's been really good to talk with you and chat about your story. I'll put it back up on the screen for everyone. It's A Left Answer to Inflation. It was a cover story from last September, and it's a very good piece. And I think we broadly agree with you. I think you can tell that we broadly agree with you that there needs to be some kind of an alternative presented rather than just allowing the School of Economics people from Chicago to dominate our conversation.
Absolutely. Thank you. I think that's just to end on this one thing, which is that I think, you know, the economy in particular is something that is so mystified and is so assumed that regular people shouldn't be able to talk about it and understand it. And that really benefits the status quo to say, well, you know, we just have to leave it up to the experts like Larry Summers and so on. So I'm really glad that these conversations are happening. And thank you for having me on the show to be able to talk about this.
All right. Well, thank you. Once again, I'm Kevin Gustola, co-host of the Unauthorized Disclosure podcast, asking you to become a subscriber of the Unauthorized Disclosure show. All you have to do is go to thedissenter.org, select the option to subscribe to the podcast for $4 a month or $3 if you become an annual subscriber, and then you'll get access to all the content we post week to week, our entire interviews, premium episodes, and any exclusive content. It's all yours, and you can support our little independent show that we've been doing for nearly 10 years. Thank you, and we'll be back next week with another show.